You're listening to the Tupton Children Podcast.
Okay, so start with our motivation. Again, with a sense of joy at having the opportunity to listen to the teachings. Especially that part of us that has faith and confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. That has a mind that wants to learn all of the teachings. Because lots of people have the other conditions, but then they don't have that one. Or some people have that one of really having faith in what is worthy of faith, but they're living out in some obscure area where there's no chance to meet the Dharma. So there's all sorts of hindrances that can come up. So right now, none of them are rearing their heads. So it's something to be very grateful for. And so to really use this opportunity while we have it, because one day it's going to end. And we're going to have to shift gears and, you know, deal with whatever hindrances come, and which will entail practicing in a different kind of way. So while we have this opportunity, let's recall all sentient beings, their kindness to us, how they're trapped in cyclic existence, and then generate the bodhicitta and have that as our motivation for learning tonight. So it's true, sometimes some big hindrance is going to come, isn't it?
For sure.
I mean, because there's aging, sickness, and death. And we're in the aging part. So far the sickness part hasn't been too bad. Yeah, it gets bad and then it gets better. But, you know, we'll keep getting sick. Our mind will keep getting older and less agile. And, you know, as the body and mind, you know, start degenerating, then we're going to have to adapt our practice and be able to do it differently and handle different circumstances and be able to look at all the people who don't have the hindrances we do. And instead of being jealous and instead of being angry, just say, I knew that I was going to have to shift my practice sometime, and now it's time to practice and deal with these hindrances and transform them into the path. And even if it means I don't get to do some other Dharma activities that I usually like to do, that's okay. I've had that opportunity in the past. I used it the best that I could. So now it's just time to shift gear. Yeah, and to be able to do it gracefully instead of, you know, stomping our feet and, you know, having a temper tantrum because we can't do what we used to be able to do. Sounds easy to talk about. Well, it doesn't sound easy to talk about. It sounds hard to talk about, but it's going to be even harder to do. That's why when we have the opportunity to not take it for granted and not space out and just sit, think, I'm going to have day after day after day of this kind of opportunity. Okay, so last time we were talking about the three causes for bodhisattva, which are bodhicitta, passion, what kind of bodhicitta?
Staple as a mountain.
Bodhicitta, staple as a mountain, is not the cause of a bodhisattva.
Uncontrived. Spontaneous.
Sorry, what is your question?
What kind of bodhicitta is the cause of a bodhisattva?
Fabricated bodhicitta.
Okay. Uncontrived bodhicitta can't be the cause because the moment you attain uncontrived bodhicitta, you're already a bodhisattva, and cause and effect can't exist at the same time. Okay. Why did they list compassion separately, even though compassion is actually a cause of bodhicitta?
Because it's so important.
Yeah, because it's so important. And then the non-dual wisdom, what's the dual that it's free from? The two extremes, nihilism and absolutism. Okay? Is that wisdom free of appearance of subject and object, that kind of dualism?
No.
No. Okay.
That question, though. Mm-hmm. Because the verse says, bodhicitta firm as the king of mountains. That's what the text says of those three. Is that not the kind of bodhicitta that we're asking about? Or?
That's the bodhicitta that we have when we become a bodhisattva.
I see.
Yeah. It's the sugar cane bark bodhicitta.
So I'm confused. So the verse is talking about one kind, but what we were talking about last week was the predecessor to that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so the verse, where's the verse?
It's 75.
Yeah, its roots are bodhicitta that are firm as the king of mountains, compassion that is as vast as space, and wisdom that relies not on duality. Yeah, but it's not really the bodhicitta that's as firm as the king of mountains, because that's the bodhicitta when you're already a bodhisattva.
Okay?
Yeah, so I don't know why they put that. I have to ask Nagarjuna. Yeah?
You say Askas was teaching on the two ways to develop bodhicitta and equalizing self and others, as many Vaishnavas, but I find also other sources. Why did you didn't mention them? Like, even a teacher seemed to teach that, and
say that again about equalizing exchange self mm-hmm. and others. Why did I do what?
We say that it's only taught, or you can find it in Shantidevas.
No, I said the source was.
The source.
The source was Shantideva mm-hmm. in engaging in the Bodhisattva's deeds. And the source was Nagarjuna at a line at the end here.
Right. Yeah.
That doesn't mean that the source doesn't mean the whole teaching is found there. Yeah. It's just the root where you can find a scriptural source.
Mm-hmm.
And then. But of course, Shantideva, it is found, the whole thing there. But then later people, based on that source, elaborated it and made the whole teaching.
I find also the source where the Buddha seems to be the Arya of Tree Sutra.
Arya of Tree mm-hmm. Sutra?
Array of Tree Sutra.
Array. Array of trees. Mm-hmm. There's the array of stalks. That's the Gandavyuha. The one with the King of Prayers. I don't know, see if you can find that sutra somewhere. Yeah? Okay. No, but you really start to see that a lot of the things that we study are things that there's a source in the sutra, but then an Indian pandit expanded it, mm-hmm. or a Tibetan expanded it, and we learned the expanded version. But all the points we learn are not necessarily found in that sutra. Okay? Like the seven-point instruction of cause and effect. I don't think, I'm not sure, but I don't think you could find that in a sutra 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's rooted in Atisha, who probably learned it from Sirlingpa. But you know, where did Serlingpa get it? Or did he just look at the sutras and read different sutras and pull different information out of it and then make those seven? Like the Bodhisattva vows are taken from many different sutras. We don't find that the Buddha said, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in one sutra. So a lot of things are like that.
I think I just listened to this and the Kendra wound up and he said that 7-point cost effect also goes back to a Sangha.
Yeah, to a Sangha and Kamala Sila. Yeah. But then, you know, can you find it specifically in a sutra?
Mm.
You know. And what I find quite interesting, to go off the topic a little bit, you know, in the thing about all sentient beings have been your mother, as many times as there's, you know, all the, you know, you can count all the juniper berries in the world, and it's even more than that. Well, in they have that analogy in the Pali Sutra, so it was probably in some Srivastavada Sanskrit Sutra too. Yeah, but it was, the analogy was that was how many times you had been born in samsara. Yeah, so whether it was taken there and then extrapolated on, or maybe in the Srivastavada Sutra, it was a little bit different. It was that, you know, it's hard to say when you trace these things back exactly what they were. Yeah, and you look sometimes like, you know, everybody's, what Nagarjuna said was like so original and so fantastic. Actually, a lot of it is in the Pali text. Yeah, the whole thing about things not being produced by self, others, both, and causelessly, there's a refutation of suffering being produced in any of those four ways in the Pali Sutras. Yeah, so it's quite interesting when you look back. I mean, I'd really, if I had some free time and some language skills, I mean, I'd like to trace back when was the, like the word svabhava, when was that first used and in what context? Because it seems like it was first used in the Abhidharma. But it didn't mean inherent existence in the Abhidharma. Yeah? It meant like the nature of something. And then how did that word start to change meanings and gain a bunch of different meanings to a bunch of different people? Yeah? I mean, I think that could be fascinating to really, because you're tracing back the evolution and the development of ideas. Yeah. Which the Tibetans say the ideas are not getting developed and they are not, you know, interpreting anything. They are just explaining what was already there in the sutra. And the fact that they explain different things was because that's a skillful mean, you know, that's skillful means. Like a Sangha, you know, is known as, he wrote all these Chittamatra texts mostly, except for his commentary on Kulama. But in the Tibetan eyes, he's actually a Madhyamaka. But he taught Chittamatra because that was skillful for his brother Vasubandhu. Yeah. But Vasubandhu wrote the Abhidharma Kosha, which was a Vaibhasika text, and then he wrote the commentary on that, which was Satantrika. But he was actually a Chittamatra, taught by his brother, who was actually
a
Madhyamaka. So, you know, it's quite interesting to see how things get explained. And I've been reading one book, you know, that says, you know, because we have this whole thing of, you know, Nagarjuna and Aryadeva and Chandrakirti and so on, you know, explaining the what came to be the Prasangika view. It wasn't called Prasangika way back then. But there was actually, in I think 11th century, or maybe 12th, I think 11th, there was somebody, another one named Nagarjuna, who taught Tantra. And he had students named Aryadeva and Shantakirti. Yeah? And it seems like, according to this one historian, that there was a trend in ancient India at that time that people would take the names of the famous people before, and then they were kind of seen as, you know, maybe the future life of that great pandit or something, but they somehow had some connection to whoever, you know, that Chandakirti in the 11th one, who 7th century, who taught Tantra, had a connection with the Chandakirti in the 7th century, who taught Madhyamaka. Yeah? So, and that's how you get Nagarjuna list, you know, living for 600 years, except he must have had to live for more if that was 11th century and he started out in 2nd, you know? So, you know, history is not the Tibetan's forte. But it's quite interesting to see how this happens. And I'm going off on a tangent now, but I was really hoping that Rita Gross could come and teach Buddhist history here. Yeah, and we had corresponded before she died, and she was quite enthusiastic about coming. And, you know, she's done some writing about how, you know, there's the historical viewpoint, and then there's the history that's legend, and how they both have their time and place, but it's very good not to mix them up. Mm-hmm. You know, in Tibetan society, there isn't a distinguishing thing. And so she was quite shocked when she came to America, and she was teaching at some of Khandra Rinpoche centers and presenting, you know, another view of Buddhist history, and people were freaking out, you know. It would kind of be like somebody presenting Jewish history and say, you know, the Red Sea didn't split. Yeah, you know, maybe they were slaves, but they took another route and got out, but the Red Sea didn't split and the bush didn't burn. And, you know, people who take things literally, you know, totally freak out. Yeah, you see in Christianity too, when some of the basic legendary things are challenged. On the other hand, you can say they're legendary, but, you know, people who have spiritual powers, strange things happen. You know, there's paranormal things. We can't just say, well, you know, I didn't see it and that doesn't fit my scientific paradigm, therefore it didn't happen. So, you know, maybe the Red Sea split. I don't know. Yeah? And maybe Nagarjuna lived 600 years. I don't know. But there's also another view that, you know, maybe it did, that the Red Sea didn't split, and, you know, Jesus went to India, and Nagarjuna lived, you know, a regular lifespan, and then, you know, that there were, some people say there were three Nagarjunas, and maybe, you know, two or three Chandakirtis, two or three Vasubandhus. I mean, the Tibetans were just gone. You can't be, you can't do that, you know. Yeah, but I don't know, it doesn't bother me. I can look at these things from many different viewpoints, and some people say this, and some people look at it this, and I can see the advantages to all the different perspectives, and I don't feel the necessity to come out and say, you know, there was a burning bush, or there wasn't a burning bush, or, you know, Jesus rose, or he didn't rise, or Nagarjuna went to the land of the Nagas, and came back without getting wet, brought the scriptures back and they weren't soggy, you know? I mean, I don't feel the need to kind of make it all fit into a coherent thing. I can see, yes, you know, like when the Buddha was born, that he took 7 steps and said, this is my last life. You know, and he came out of his mother's side, my goodness, it's a very strange kind of cesarean. Yeah. But, you know, so maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. Doesn't really matter to me. I can accept it that way, I can accept it another way. Yeah, my faith doesn't depend on these kinds of things. Yeah. So, anyway, that was a long thing. Where were we? Okay, so we were... So then, you know, he did the verse 176 asking the king to listen, you know, where he explained the Buddha bodies, and then he explained that the principal cause for the four Buddha bodies are the collection of merit and collection of wisdom, which you start collecting when you become a bodhisattva. Yeah, ordinary... us beings who haven't entered a path, and also the people in the fundamental vehicle, don't do those don't have those two collections. Although we do create merit and wisdom, but we don't have the collections of merit and wisdom. Okay, and then with 177, he's going into a whole series of verses where he's talking about how to create the causes for the Buddha's body. So these are like the not the major causes, because the major causes are the two collections, but like the more specialized causes that have a connection with that specific quality of the Buddha's body. So for me, it's kind of interesting, you know, because here he's talking about the method side of the path. He really did a lot about the wisdom side of the path in chapter one. Yeah? And now he's coming to the method side. And I ask, why did he choose to talk about the causes for a Buddha's body? Why did he choose that one? Yeah, because personally, I would like to hear the causes of the Buddha's speech, because they say that the Buddha's speech is of the body, speech, and mind is the one that's most important to sentient beings, because that's how the Buddha helps us, is by the Buddha's speech. Yeah, so why is he describing the causes of the Buddha's body? Yeah, maybe we can ask Jeffrey. I wonder if he thought of that. He has many of the same questions. You know, because I remember the first time I heard this, because there's also an explanation in Mahayana Sutra Alankara. Abhidharma. Abhisamaya Alankara, sorry.
Explanation.
Yeah. He was teaching that. So there's two different. But like, you know, to me, this doesn't inspire me as much as like if I heard the causes of the Buddha's speech. Yeah? But then I have to realize that not everybody's like me. And some people, you know, hearing the causes of the Buddha's body, like, wow, that's going to really energize them. I want to have a body that looks like that. Yeah. Refuting all the disadvantages, how filthy the human body is, and now he's presenting an alternative kind of body. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah.
I thought you maybe it's because he's talking to a king, with a certain kind of mind.
Yes.
When you compare how Aryadeva starts, right, it's like death and the foulness of the body, like the king would have run away.
Yes. Yeah. So the king probably has jewels and is, you know, he might be quite vain. And so, yeah. Yes, you have something to say?
Well, not only did he just cover the foulness of the body, probably because he sees the king has a lot of attachment to his body,
yeah.
But maybe he thinks this will interest the king because the king does have so much attachment
yeah.
to his body.
Yeah, that's exactly it. clearly attached to his body, so then King's going to go, I want this kind of body. Okay. And also because in ancient India, these 32 signs, you know, people in general knew about them. It isn't something in our culture that these qualities that are necessarily, we don't revere them, these qualities, you know, like if they said, I don't know, like you'd have muscles like Rambo or something like that, you know, then maybe, you know, or you'd have a figure like Lady Gaga. Maybe some people would be interested, you know, but in the time, you know, ancient India, these were the traits that were seen as very beautiful, as, you know, and desirable. Yeah, so appealing to people's vanity, but, you know, to get these, you have to drop a lot of other stuff. Okay, so due to honoring Chaitas and those who were worthy, Aryas and also elders, your glorious hands and feet will be wheel marked, showing that you shall turn the wheel. Okay, so this is the first of the 32. So Chaita usually means stupa. You know, in Tibetan the word is chorten, and chorten means a base of offering. Yeah, so it's the base that you make an offering to. So it usually refers to stupas, the monuments, you know, and they usually put like relics of a Buddha, relics of a great master inside. And they usually symbolize the Buddha or the Buddha's mind. And so, you know, when we set up an altar, we have a stupa on it symbolizing the Buddha's mind. But here, Chaita refers to the Buddha himself or to something that is blessed or empowered by the Buddha. It refers to the Arya Sangha, to our preceptors, to our Dharma teachers. So it goes beyond just referring, you know, symbolizing the Buddha's mind or referring to the Buddha. Okay? And the reason, you know, I mean, it serves as a symbol of the Buddha, and so these things are honored and respected as if they were the Buddha, because the Buddha has all the good qualities and has abandoned all hindrances. So, you know, in our culture, you know, there's some religions that have, you know, holy statues and things. And then there's other religions that, no, you can't have any image of God or any image of the divine. Yeah. So it's quite interesting, you know. When I was in Israel and I was teaching a retreat at a kibbutz, then they asked me to come talk to the kibbutzniks one evening, and there was one woman there who was like, she was so upset, like, you have a statue of Buddha and you bow to the statue and that is idol worship, you know, and in the Ten Commandments, you know, no idol worship. So Jews, Muslims, I don't know who else, but you know, no Christians. They have Jesus hanging on the cross, the Catholics do. But, you know, you're not allowed to have images of the divine. So she was like very upset. Oh, there's a statue of a human being and he has genitals and why are you bowing to that? Shouldn't the divine be more than that? She's really quite upset. So I tried to explain it to her as, you know, this was a symbol of the Buddha's qualities. I didn't get into the whole thing that on the third part of the path of accumulation that you can receive teachings direct from stupas and, you know, and that we invoke the Buddha's holy mind inside the stupas. I didn't tell her that, you know. But I just said we see it as a representative. Like when you travel, you take a picture of your family to remind you, because you care about them. So here we take an image of the Buddha to remind us of the Buddha's qualities. You know, we're not worshiping the piece of metal. It's not a golden calf. And then I told the story, which I don't know how far it got in. But you know, if you go to Jerusalem, they have the Wailing Wall there. And people go. I went when I was there a few times. And you go, and people are standing in front and praying, you know, to that wall. And stuffing prayers inside of it. I mean, they're praying to God, but there's something about God that's inside that wall. You know? And they all write their prayers on pieces of paper and stuff it in the cracks and everything. And I said, you know, for people from another religion, when they see Jews at the Wailing Wall, it looks to them like they're worshiping a wall. You know? Now, for you, you wouldn't say you're worshiping the stones. Well, in the same way, as Buddhists, we don't say we're worshipping the material of the statue. Yeah. But it's, you know, it really shows how easy people can misunderstand things from other religions. Yeah. When I was in Dharamsala, when a whole group of a Jewish delegation came to me with His Holiness in 1990, they had... The Tibetans and the Jews had Friday night dinner together. It was Shabbat. And so right before sunset, you know, everybody was gathered there. But the Jews faced the sun. You know, they faced Jerusalem, sorry. They faced Jerusalem, which from India is in the west, not in the east. And so they were bowing and praying and swaying and dancing and everything that they do to welcome the Sabbath in, thinking of the holy city of Jerusalem. And the Tibetans thought that they were worshiping the sun. And they said to us afterwards, why are these people worshiping the sun? You know, that's what pagans do. And no, no, they're not worshiping the sun. But you know, it's like this kind of thing, how so many misunderstandings arise. Okay, so I went off on another thing, but yeah, okay. So, you know, he also says that those who are worthy include our parents and also people who are ill, yeah. And elders refer to our seniors. So to respect them and serve them and do things for them, which is totally un-American. We don't do that at all. We complain about our seniors. We pick faults at them. And we refuse to acknowledge that they have anything decent to say. Isn't it? When you're a teenager? Yeah? Your seniors are like out the window. Except Bernie Sanders. Yeah, he had some good ideas, but you know, the way we don't have much respect for our elders. So you know, it's elders in age, but it's also elders in ordination, or elders in terms of how long people have had the Bodhisattva precepts. Okay. So the other day we were talking that if somebody's going off the deep end and doing something really, you know, non-virtuous, then seniority doesn't matter. You need to talk about whatever it is with the person or make it known to the community. Yeah? But we shouldn't go to the other end of that and say, well, then seniority means nothing and, you know, just forget it and let's pick faults at people. Because that doesn't help our own mind very much if we pick faults, which I am very good at doing. I remember, you know, when I was first ordained, I looked up the line at my seniors, and that one's angry, and that one this, and that one this, and that one that, you know, and I had many complaints. I looked down the line, and also many complaints. And then it was quite nice, like some years later when I noticed there was a change and when I could look up the line and I thought, oh, this person has this talent, this has that talent. Not that they had gained new talents or qualities. I mean, I'm sure they did because of their practice, but rather my mind had changed and I wasn't She'll fill with jealousy and anger. Yeah, mostly jealousy. Yeah. Okay. So the wheel, yeah, that are on the palms of the hand, the soles of the feet, it's the Dharma wheel. So it represents capacity and power, because you know how when we make the mandala offerings, we have the different possessions of the Chakravarti King, the Universal Emperor, and one is the wheel. So it symbolizes, for him, worldly power. You know, for the Buddha, it symbolizes, spiritual power. Okay? So it's the result of having made offerings to the Buddha and having honored those worthy of respect for many Buddha, for many eons. So here it just says making offerings to the Buddha. Now you can sit and think, well, what does making offerings to the Buddha mean? Yeah? Because there's all sorts of different ways people make offerings to the Buddha. And you see it, you know. Some people, it's like you put flowers, you put incense, put water bowls. And in their minds, what you're offering is just that. Just whatever the physical object is that you're putting on the altar, that is the offering. Okay? Now what we're taught is that what you put on the altar is just the base, and that in your mind you multiply it and expand it, you know, and make Samantabhadra offerings out of it and fill the whole space, and you have the extensive offering practice, you know, because of that, and do that. And then you also learn that you should make offerings with bodhicitta. And then you should see yourself as the one who's offering, the action of offering, the substance that's being offered, the one who's being offered to, all these things as empty and dependent arising. So there's a whole lot of different ways to make offerings, isn't there? And they all look the same on the altar. But the amount of merit you create by them is hugely different, dependent on what's going on in your mind while you're offering. You know, if you're imagining the whole space full of beautiful things, and if you have a bodhicitta attitude, and if you're seeing all these things as empty and dependent. Yeah? Okay? So there's that. There's also offering service. Here it's talking about physical offerings. We'll get more into offering service. And also offering our practice. Okay, then 179. So it's something to think about, you know, like what, when he says, yeah, offering to the Chaitanya, what does that mean? Which kind of offering is he talking about? Or maybe he's talking about all three. There's probably some others too. Yeah, because you're not just seeing it as, you know, the early chaitas were just a pile of stones or a pile of dirt. You're not seeing it as that. You have to see it as, you know. So do you see it as one Buddha? Do you see it as a whole pure land filled with Buddhas and Bodhisattvas? Yeah. That makes a whole difference, doesn't it? Yeah? So many different ways to make an offering. Make offerings according to, you know, how much we've learned and how much we try and practice what we've learned. Okay, then next verse, 178. So, King, always be steadfast in your commitments concerning the Dharma. That way you shall become a bodhisattva who has level and even feet. So the soles of our feet are arched. The Buddha's feet are completely flat. You know, like when you see when they take the rubbings of the Buddha's feet at Bodh Gaya, I mean, he has enormous feet, bigger than Michael Phelps. And he has big feet. Yeah. But he's not a Buddha. Well, maybe, I don't know. But, you know, and the whole footprint is there. Whereas ours, if you take a footprint, the arch you have. And for us, if our arch is flat, it hurts, doesn't it? Yeah, so we always have to have things to keep our arch up. Okay, so the Buddha's feet are level, yeah, but they're flat, at like the underside of a tortoise. Interesting, you know, analogy. I wonder why he chose that. There's so many flat things. Why did he choose the underside of a tortoise? Yeah? This is probably Gyaltsen Jay. Yeah? Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so to become a Buddha with this sign, you have to keep whatever precepts and commitments you've taken to keep them well and not let them deteriorate. And also to remember what you've learned and to hold that in mind. Okay? And so this sign also comes as a result of practicing wisdom and method evenly and inseparably while on the Bodhisattva path. So he's saying two causes for this one. Yeah. So that one of, you know, practicing wisdom and method evenly and inseparably, that one you can see, you know, how it matches with this physical quality. You know, keeping your precepts, how does that pertain to something that's flat?
Stable.
Maybe something that's stable. Yeah,
foundation.
Not wobbly. Then 179, through generosity and gentle speech, and by acting beneficently and consistently, you will have hands and feet with digits joined by glorious webs. Okay. So we have gaps between our fingers. They say that a Buddha's fingers, they're kind of web-like, like a duck, you know? But it's not actual flesh. I mean, you could still put a ring on your finger, but it's, you know, it's more like a duck, something in there. So that must have been some sign of beauty or something, you know, quite special in them, you know. So the flesh is the nature of light, they say. Yeah. I remember meeting one Rinpoche who had, like, you know, the part of your fingers here, his were quite high up. Yeah. Okay, so this results from practicing the four ways of gathering disciples, you know, to ripen their mind strengths. So what were those four ways?
Giving
material things.
Kind and gentle voice.
Speaking kindly and about the Dharma.
Encouraging
them to practice.
Good,
yeah, practicing what you preach and being a good example. Okay, yeah. So that, through generosity. So what's the connection? You know, because with a lot of these, you know, you have a physical, it's like the physical thing is representing the action or the virtue that you've created. So through generosity and gentle speech and by acting beneficently, you will have hands and feet with the webs. Do you see any connection between those actions and the...
Is that four?
Oh, yeah, four spaces. Yeah, that's true. Yeah?
Something about, you know, generosity and acting sometimes is this kind of motion. So to be able to give to others, having these beautiful hands that just sort of represent the heart that's giving.
Yeah.
It would be really beautiful hands.
Beautiful hands with webs that can hold
a lot.
Mm-hmm. To give. Yeah. And gentle speech.
Maybe just the idea of connection and bringing together.
Mm.
Gathering.
Yeah. Yeah, connecting. That's true. Yeah. Because 180. Through abundantly giving the best food and drink, your glorious hands and feet will be soft, and you will have a large body with seven broadly curved parts. Okay, so offering lots of food and drink to people who are hungry and thirsty results in two signs. So the first sign is that our feet and hands will be very soft, like even softer than a baby's skin. And that there's seven broadly curved parts. So I think I'm going to need some help with this. Two hands, two feet, two shoulders, and the nape of our neck. So how are they broadly curved? I mean, our shoulders, okay, are curved. Yeah, maybe it does, because it says specifically that they're not concave. And so here, yeah, maybe here that this is going concave. So maybe it's referring more to where the hand joins the ankle. Yeah. And then our feet, are they curved? Maybe the soles of our feet.
And the calves.
The heel. The heel is curved. Yeah, no, the calves is different. That's our leg.
But the arch, maybe it definitely has a...
Yeah, but remember, we just... Buddha has
flat feet.
You have flat feet.
Maybe it's the top there, the curves.
Maybe the top of the foot is curved. Okay. Yeah. So, the thing with the hands, you know, again, offering food and drink. Yeah, so, but it makes your hands soft. Well, like your mind is soft. Making offerings. 181, through renouncing violence and freeing those to be killed, your body will be beautiful, straight, and tall. You will have a long life. Oops. Computer move. You will have a long life, your digits will be long, and your heels broad. Okay, so if we refrain from harming others, that should be refrain instead of restrain. With harming others from malice, and if we save the lives of humans, animals, insects, you know, who are about to be killed, then it brings the sign that we'll have a tall and beautiful body. Yeah. So that makes sense, doesn't it? You know, you protect life, you're very upright as a person, so you're tall, beautiful, you have an attractive, powerful kind of appearance that people will be attracted to because you've done this beautiful action of saving life. Okay? And then also, by abandoning crooked or deceptive dealings with others, our body will be straight. So again, that makes sense, not being crooked, having a straight body. And then the seventh one is through all of that, you'll have our fingers and toes will be long, and you'll have broad heels. Now, it's interesting, because these are the ones that were listed in the commentary, but in the verse it says you will have a long life. But that's the result similar to the cause, isn't it, in terms of the experience. So, long fingers and toes, broad heels.
Stable.
Yeah, again, stable, isn't it? If things are long and big and not so wobbly. 182, through enhancing the practices that you have undertaken, you will be glorious. You will have a good complexion. Your ankles will not be prominent, and you will be marked with body hairs that curl upwards. Okay, so keeping our precepts, spreading the Dharma, yeah, so enhancing the practices that we've undertaken. So that causes the ninth one is good color, good complexion, you know, and ankles that don't jut out. So I guess.
What does it mean?
Hmm?
What does it mean?
Just stick out.
Stick out.
So, yeah. So ankles that don't jut out, and then our body hairs all go up. So, you know, the hair on your arm, instead of going down, would go up. I guess the head on your hair would go up. There's another one later about your hair curling. You know, but the hair on your legs also would go up. So something unusual. Yeah. So enhancing your practices is unusual. You know, most of you beings don't do that. 183, by both learning and imparting with respect the sciences, crafts, and other fields of knowledge, you will have the calves of an antelope and have a sharp mind and great wisdom. Okay, so as a result of having both received instructions and then having given instructions about the arts and sciences and, you know, grammar and poetry and all these different fields of knowledge, when we become a Buddha, then our calves will be beautiful. There's some special type of antelope that I guess has quite beautiful calves. And mentally will be intelligent and wise. I mean, mentally the result makes complete sense, doesn't it? Then 184, through the avowed practice of quickly giving your wealth at the request of others, your arms will be broad and facile, and you will be a leader of the world. Okay, so when we're committed to helping others and we respond immediately when somebody asks for some kind of aid or help, okay, so then you'll have very long arms, like the Buddha's. So they say that the Buddha's arms are like an elephant's trunk. They're very long. They go down to his knees. You know, when a Buddha stands, do they go down on the Burmese statues do we have? Yeah? Yeah, they have long arms, don't they? Yeah? So the Buddha's arms go down to his knees. Yeah, Kenzo Rinpoche says, not like our knees that only go below, not like our arms that only go below our knees when we slouch. Okay, yeah. And you'll be a leader of the world. That makes sense, doesn't it? You know, through being generous, quickly responding to others. Yeah, then of course people will allow you as a leader. Or, you know, want you as a leader. That's why I don't get it when they, you know, they want to elect people who just cut. Yeah? Okay. Nagarjuna would have something to say about that. The Pope said something about Trump, too.
He did?
Yes.
What did he say?
Well, yesterday he was at the Rio Grande, the border. You know, where he did there's a memorial there for the people who have died trying to cross into the States. And so he did some prayers there, and then he offered mass, right at the border, the Rio Grande, and it was broadcast simultaneous in a stadium in El Paso, Texas. And then that was his last day in Mexico, I guess, and when he was going back, some news person asked him what he thought about Trump. And he said, anybody who wants to, he didn't mention Trump's name, but he said, maybe the guy asked him what he thought about the Republican candidates, I can't remember. But anyway, he said, anybody who wants to build a wall instead of a bridge isn't a Christian. because he spoke a lot apparently in Mexico. I mean, it's such a tragedy. How many thousands of people have died, especially people from Central America trying to come up, you know, and the Mexicans, and then they drown in the river, they cross the river, they're in the desert, there's no water, they dry, they die. I mean, it's horrible. Yeah. So the Pope is speaking out on some good social issues. Yeah. It's nice. It'll be interesting to see what people say. I mean, Marco Rubio is a Catholic, but he also wants strict, you know, depart the people. But, you know, hey, all of us are from immigrant families, except the few Native Americans.
Rubio particularly.
Yeah, and he's the child of an immigrant. I guess Cruz was born in Canada, and Scalia was the child of an immigrant. Yeah. So I don't know. Be nice to have Nagarjuna talk to me. The Republicans, you know, sit them down, give them some good advice.
Nagarjuna's letter to the Republicans.
We should write it.
I think we have a song.
Well, so many of these, as you go farther down in the verses, to think that, to have a world leader who thought like this, this would be an entirely different world.
Yeah, completely. Completely.
Even a few of them.
Yeah.
When I studied politics, I thought it would be nice because they're political coaches, right? Who give advice to the politicians, somebody who had this background or like Nagarjuna, when I received it from Vigila Sampardon, kind of he spoke about that, that it would be very nice to have coaches like that.
Yeah. They'd probably get fired very quickly. But it's quite interesting, isn't it, the mentality, because it seems like people in this time, they really admired people who were gentle and patient and generous and kind. And now we don't admire those people. We say them as soft and weak. Yeah, they're weak. We admire people who punch you in the nose. I mean, it's really rather base, isn't it? You know, people who, yeah, have aggressive power, that's the ones that are somehow in our world seen as good, which...
The country upper Canada, not because I'm coming from Canada, but Justin Trudeau, I've been reading him. Mm-hmm. Have you read about what he's saying?
No.
You should. It's like the Dalai Lama talking.
Really?
Yes. Really. I'm wow.
Oh, good for the Canadians. I wish we could pick the Abbey up and move it. What, 100 miles north and put it down?
So do I.
Just the Air Force, we had planes, Canadian planes, and you know, with ISIS and all of that. Mm-hmm. He took that out. Mm. And he says, and he was asked why you did that. And I loved his answer. He said, we are all, us Canadians, we are good on the field to help people, to guide them and you know, rebuild whatever. That was so wise.
Yeah.
Remove anything that could kill, and well, I don't know if everything, but and now he's helping the people.
infrastructure and all of that. We teach the people to take care of themselves too.
Yeah.
I know it. So,
yeah.
To read, really to read.
Maybe some of it will rub off south of the border here.
I know. So, it's lighting day.
Okay, so you will be a leader of the world, a kind, compassionate, powerful leader that will lead people in the direction of virtue. Yeah. Then 185, through seeing to the reconciliation of friends who have had a falling out, you will be a holy person with secret organ retracted into the abdomen. So they say that the Buddha's sex organ retracts inside like that of a horse. So it's a result of reconciling those who aren't in harmony. Interesting. Okay, 186. By giving pleasant and excellent dwellings adorned with carpets, your skin will have a gentle hue like refined, untarnished gold. Okay, so continually offering dwelling places to the Sangha that has carpets and cushions and bedding and everything, it will result in, when you're a Buddha, your skin having hue like refined gold. You know, because they said the Buddha's skin was like it had a golden sheen to it. And you can see some Indians, their skin is that color. You know, you can see a golden sheen. But when we visualize the Buddha, we visualize him as completely golden in color. Okay, so it makes our skin will be like refined gold, and also sign 15, our skin will be soft and fine. Okay, and then 187, through giving unexcelled authority and properly following your guru, your resplendent body hairs will grow one by one, and your face will be adorned with the forehead curl. Okay, so by repeatedly empowering those who ask for help, you know, when we have the power and authority to do so, by correctly following our spiritual mentors in our study and contemplation and meditation, then that results in the sign that each hair on the body grows separately from its own pore. So you don't, I guess, have two hairs growing out of one pore. They're singular. And then also the forehead curl. So the forehead curl is actually a very special sign. It usually takes more merit to get the forehead curl. You know, it's a curl of hair here, and apparently it's usually curled up, but apparently you can take it and pull it out to the end of the universe. It's quite long. And then, you know, when you let go, it comes back into a very small curl. Yeah. They say some of the Mahayana sutras at the beginning, you know, the Buddha, somebody, he extends his curl out into the universe.
I knew somebody who had that curl and was really an excellent follower of his teacher.
Was what?
An excellent follower of his teacher.
Follower of his teacher, yeah. Okay. So the curl is sign number 17. I haven't been saying all the numbers, so if you need me to go through from state them again, I can do that. Then 188, by listening properly, speaking in a pleasing manner, and acting in accord with the well-spoken, your shoulders will be well-rounded and you will have a leonine, leonine upper body. Okay? So, due to not speaking harsh words or insulting, ridiculing, making fun of people, trying to really speak in a pleasant way, you know, that's coming from a good space in our own heart. And by when people ask us questions, to respond in accord with their disposition, you know, when they're asking us Dharma questions, to respond in accord with what they're capable of understanding, then this results in two signs. 18 is our shoulders are well-rounded. Yeah. And so I guess not like bony, but... Yeah. And then 19, the chest or the upper part of the body will be broad and powerful like that of a lion. So interesting, by listening properly and speaking in a pleasant manner and acting in accord with the well-spoken. So this is somebody who is, gentle, well-mannered, polite, but not artificial about it. Yeah. Then they have this very powerful looking body. Not wimp body, powerful looking body. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Okay. And here, by listening properly, we have a lot of teachings on how to speak. We don't have a lot of teachings on how to listen. Actually, it's a big skill. It's a skill we need to learn, how to listen. Yeah. I mean, they always teach how to speak, but in order to speak, like here, how describing how the Buddha teaches, speaking in a way that, that's in accord with somebody's disposition and capacity and so on. In order to be able to speak like that, you have to be able to listen well. Or you have to have clairvoyant powers. So they say it's one of the uses of a Buddha's, of the divine eye. But also, if you learn how to listen well, then you can get an idea, too, of what's going to be a suitable answer for somebody. And this is really, really important, And this is also why it's important we know what the antidotes are to different things. Because if we get confused, and let's say a guest comes here and asks us a question, we could give them the wrong antidote, okay? So, for example, if somebody comes and tells us, I'm falling asleep in my meditation, what do I do? And we say, meditate on death. Is that the correct antidote? No, why not? It makes his mind go even more down, more lethargic, more discouraged, okay? So instead you have to talk to them about something that will make them feel happy and glad and uplift the mind, okay? So with all these things, we have to know what the antidotes are, and then we have to be able to suss somebody out, yeah? And also, some people, let's say, there's a mantra commitment. Some people, come to you and say, I'm totally freaking out about counting these numbers. It's driving me crazy. What Lama Yeshe used to do then is he made the commitment either 3 months of Vajrasattva or 100,000. Yeah? So for the people who were freaking out, just about counting, just do 3 months, But say the mantra continuously, and he had people, we were doing 2-hour sessions, the whole retreat. You're looking like, gee, I wish I had known that.
The perfectionist says, I really do it, again in 3 months.
Yeah. So, so to be able to say, some people, which people you need to say, no, you got to complete the 111,000, focus yourself, do it, And then which people will say, oh, the counting doesn't matter, that's not so important, just, be relaxed about it. So different people need different things, so we have to be able to suss it out and see how to respond. And similarly too, when people come and you know, they're upset about one thing or another. And, you know, which people do you look at and you say, what's going on in your mind? And which people do you look at and say, oh, that must be so painful and disturbing to you? Yeah? So to know how to deal with different people when they have problems, because it's not one size fits all. Okay. Okay, we'll do one more first. Through serving and healing the sick, this is 189, through serving and healing the sick, you will have a broad back, you will be imperturbable, and all tastes will be supreme. Okay, so you're providing medicine, you're providing bedside care to people who are sick, to people who are injured. And so it results, you know, you have a broad back. I mean, you're bearing the weight of their suffering. Okay, you will be imperturbable. And then all tastes will be supreme. I guess because you get used to the food they feed you in the hospital. But Gyatso Rinpoche is saying that when we take care of people who are sick, then we should do it with respect and consideration and not just like, oh, you're sick, what a pain in the neck, I have to come take care of you. But, you know, we should do it respectfully and hand them something, you know, with both hands. Similarly, you know, if we are giving food to somebody who's poor, we should wash it first, then give it to them, make sure we're giving clean food, offer it with both hands, look them in the eye, which is very different than just walking by and, you know, avoiding the person and putting something in a bowl and going on. Okay? And so, as a result of that, you'll have broad shoulders and a broad chest, and you'll always experience excellent tastes, no matter what they serve at Shravasti Abbey. So, there's stories, you know, in the suttas about the Buddha, and like once there was a famine, and so they only had, somebody came and donated hay, horse fodder, for them. And who was it, Ananda or somebody tasted it and it was like, and then gave it to the, they didn't want to give it to the Buddha, but you know, the Buddha took it and it was like heavenly taste. So, yeah. You know, when you have a lot of merit, then things tastes good. What?
Isn't it also like, you know, when you practice a community, you're serving everybody, you're respectful to everybody, and so the food is equal to your mind?
Yeah. Okay, any questions?
I'm kind of embarrassed to ask this one. So who sees this body? And ordinary beings don't see these marks. And if I wanted to really get inspired, then it's like the way someone moves through space. You know, you know, the way a person's mind gets refined. Mm-hmm. And so, what, you know, so what is this about?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, are you going to start checking people's heels to see if they're broad? And look at their fingers to see if they're webbed?
And then, when you're a fully awakened Buddha, you don't have... they're not looking at each other with these signs and parts of it.
Yeah.
So, for me, I'm having trouble with this being inspired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you're saying, like, who has this kind of body?
An ordinary mind can't see.
Uh-huh.
An ordinary mind like mine, I can't see.
Yeah, we can't. Well, they say that on the Buddha's body, the emanation body, you could. Yeah, apparently the Buddha, when he was alive, people could see these signs on his body. Yeah. Well, it's to inspire us, you know, if we want to have the Buddha's body. It's not to check out and see who's a Buddha and who's not. It's to think of a Buddha's body being very magnificent and very unlike our bodies. And so to be inspired to create the causes that would lead to that. And if you look, all these causes are very wonderful things to do, aren't they?
They are.
Yeah. I find the causes more inspiring than the physical signs.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, because he's getting very specific here on what kind of causes on the method side that you want to do.
So at what point are we rid of this?
This body?
This.
Well, they say that first Bhumi Bodhisattvas on Path of Seeing, some of them have mental bodies, but definitely by the eighth Buddha, Bhumi, the eighth ground, you have a mental body. Okay? So what a mental body looks like, I don't know. Yeah. That is for sure not like ours. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's not going to have the same elements. It's not going to be solid like ours. Yeah.
I have a question from last week.
Uh-huh.
Last week you talked a little bit about the basis, path, and the result.
Uh-huh.
In Sutra and Tantra. And in Tantra you talked about the path, but is the basis and the result the same as the Sutra?
Okay.
So it doesn't seem like the two truths could change.
Yeah, the two truths wouldn't change. The resultant Buddha bodies wouldn't change.
Okay, so it's just the path.
Yeah, it's probably, yeah, it's basically the path.
The basis would be different.
Huh?
The basis would be different.
How would the basis be different?
Well, I'm thinking of Yamataka practice. The basis is described as ordinary death and immediate state and rebirth. That's the basis.
Oh, I see. Yeah, but that's in the system where you're making, you're making analogies. The death, barter, and rebirth, and the three kayas. But then, because usually the basis is the two truths. Yeah. So you would have to have two bases, wouldn't you? If you're going to have a path. If you're going to have two things in the path, one for method and one for wisdom, and, you know, the Dharmakaya and the Rupakaya, then wouldn't you have to have two things as a basis?
Well, there's three. I mean, there's three.
Yeah.
Results, aren't there?
Yeah. But, like, how would you put them? Which ones would correspond with the Rupakaya, which ones would with the Dharmakaya? Probably death would with the Dharmakaya. Yeah. Rebirth with the Rupakaya. Yeah. But then Sambhogakaya. Yeah, it's the bardo that would go there. Yeah.
So one way of saying it would be death, bardo, rebirth.
Yeah.
But it's still grounded in the two truths.
What we're saying is that if it's ordinary death, bardo, and rebirth, yeah, you would have to do it in terms of how they were transformed. So ordinary death would correlate with the clear light and the truth body, and bardo and rebirth would correlate with the two form bodies. And with illusory body as your path. Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Someone asked if arahants have some of these physical bodies.
Oh, they say that, that some Chakravarta kings have these signs, some bodhisattvas do. I think some arhats probably can, but they aren't anything like the Buddhist signs.
Last week you said similitude.
Yeah. Similitude. It's a good word, isn't it?
thought it was interesting when I read this about the coloring of the skin.
Mm-hmm.
And how when I saw Geshe Sopa close to when he was dying, that his skin was so luminous in almost copper color.
Yeah.
It was so interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just, it was like seeing something of gold.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it seemed very much like that.
I have a nerve question too. It comes a little bit in the chin. The Tibetans don't look, for example, at his holiness directly in the face, and some see him as a Buddha. What does this correlation do? You know something about that?
Tibetan?
You know, when his holiness is teaching and he's going maybe on the stage, and then there are Tibetans, and they don't look directly to the holinesses.
Oh,
they bow down.
Yeah, yeah. They don't make eye contact with the
sun.
This is Tibetan manners. Mm-hmm. I mean, in old Tibet, nobody even looked at His Holiness because he had this huge high seat. Everybody would come in with eyes lowered. Now, you know, it's quite different. People do look at His Holiness and make eye contact. Many people, when His Holiness is coming in, usually, yes, out of respect, you have your head down and you don't look. Is that what you were asking?
Yeah, I just wanna, out of respect, okay, that's
yeah.
The manner.
Yeah, it's out of respect. Yeah, like in the posada,
mm-hmm.
You know, when the preceptor's speaking to you, out of respect, then you have your eyes lowered. You know, you're not. Yeah. Why are you giving me advice? I didn't ask for it. Okay, good. And we'll stop.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losam's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Yidam Gurratna Mandala Kamniryatayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds
of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the